Thanks for downloading the In Our Time podcast. For more details about In Our Time and for our terms of use, please go to bbc.co.uk/radio4. I hope you enjoy the programme. Hello. In 1757, Lord Clive, an army officer for the East India Company, won a battle at Plassey. This established the company's dominance over much of the Indian subcontinent. But there was a rumour that within 100 years there would be a revolt. And so it proved. A century later, on the 17th of March, 1857, an Indian soldier in the company's army shot his officers and was hanged. Within 2 months, his comrades had mutinied, and from there rebellion spread across northern India. After great violence on both sides, the revolt was suppressed, but it left British rule in India transformed and arguably doomed. But why did so many Indians rise up against British rule? It's a story of economic strains, religious insensitivity, and well-intentioned but provocative liberal reforms. Ever since the once-called Indian Mutiny, it's been swathed in myths, conjured by everyone from British press to Indian nationalists. With me to discuss the Indian Rebellion are Faisal Devji, University Reader in Indian History at St. Anthony's College, University of Oxford, Shruti Kapila, University Lecturer in History and Fellow and Director of Studies at Corpus Christi College, University of Cambridge, and Chandrika Kohl, Lecturer in Imperial and Indian History at the University of St. Andrews. Chandrika, until 1857, the events we're going to discuss, India wasn't ruled directly by the British government, but a lot of it was run by this commercial company, the East India Company, set up by Elizabeth I in 1600. How well was this working, let's come closer to 1857, in the 1850s?
I think on the face of it, it was working very well. The company, of course, was no longer the commercial entity. It was very much a political and military state wedded to the government in London, and it operated, therefore, on different lines. It was a military state. It depended largely on three major armies, the Bengal, the Bombay, and the Madras armies. And in the first half of the 19th century, it was marked by a series of wars that it led right across the country, right across the subcontinent, from the south right up to Punjab in the north, which was finally conquered by the company in the name of the crown in the 1840s, by the end of the 1840s. So the fact of it being a commercial trading company was no longer true. It had, in fact, lost its monopoly as a trading company in 1813. And by 1833, it had pretty much, commerce had pretty much taken a back seat in its operations. Its military campaigns in India reflected its desire to establish what it claimed to be the Pax Britannica. So it was waging war in order to have peace, in order to trade and have proper administration. It claimed to be run on sort of modernist lines. Its claim to modernity rested on such things as the establishment of efficient administration, the establishment of a legal system, the collection of data and the processing of data, the establishment of communication systems, and overall the establishment of an ethos of a national as opposed to a regional or sectarian or sectional sort of entity. However, having said that, on the one hand you can claim that on the face of it, it was paramount, but this was sort of beginning to breed a kind of complacency, a kind of hubris. And this is best reflected in the way it was mismanaging the company, that is, the way it was seemingly mismanaging the military, which was, of course, the backbone of the company.
Before we get to the military, we're going to play the key part in this. Their policy, the company had policies. It was still a company. So we're still talking about a company. We're not talking about a country. It's coupled with, it's representative of, but it's still a company. But it had policies on religion and social reform, which were beginning to breed discontent. Maybe had done for a long time, but let's talk about it in just a few years before the rebellion.
Yes, and I think it's important to note that a lot of these reforms and its religious position was being dictated increasingly by London. And I'm, for instance, referring particularly to the evangelical movement in London. This pushed the company away from its position of, for instance, not allowing missionaries to operate in its territories in the early part of the 19th century. It was forced by the 1910s and 20s to allow missionaries to operate. And Christian evangelicalism was therefore increasingly associated with the company Raj, mistakenly, in actual fact, because in terms of the amount of people who were converted, the numbers were very small, but it was creating an impression that the company was behind some kind of a big push to Christianize India. So the Christian, you know, in a country in Britain at this time, you know, civilization and Christianity were seen to be part of the same picture. The British saw this as part of reforming of Indian customs and society. But on the other hand, there were also moves made by people like Lord Bentinck, like Lord Macaulay, who was the first law member of the council, which touched upon trying to alleviate some of what they saw as the social ills of Hinduism, for instance.
Faisal Devli, how did Indians see the British? We're talking still before the rebellion, largely. Were they seen as intrusive foreigners or exotic foreigners in a country, in a subcontinent which had many languages, many influences there? Were they just another lot turning up?
Well, I think, yes, they were initially. Though, of course, as Chandrika said, once the company assumed dominance over large parts of the subcontinent, there were much more than simply another group of people. And therefore, what came to be important for many Indians was not their character as foreigners so much as their nature as rulers. And those two things are actually distinct. I think it's very important to note that they're distinct, that even when the company started being criticized for the way in which it ruled or its religious policies such as they were, it was not because the English were seen as being foreign so much, but rather because they were seen as breaking a kind of what we might describe as a moral compact with the Indians over whom they ruled. And so even once you get to the early period of the mutiny, if you look at mutineer pamphlets, for instance, what is important, what is crucial, is the fact that the English are not disliked for being, a foreign group of people, a different racial or ethnic group, or indeed, a people who are strange and whose habits we cannot understand. That's of not much issue to the mutineers themselves, let alone to those who remain loyal to the British. Rather, what is at issue is the fact that the English are seen to have been virtuous at one point, which is why they ruled India, and that they seem to have betrayed their own virtue.
Because before then, as I understand it, by and large, the British turning up with a tiny finger hold or fingernail hold on India as a little trading company that's somewhere near Calcutta, as it were, they got to know Indian customs, they learnt the languages, there was intermarriage, they made a point of, perhaps they wanted to, but anyway, they made a point of settling in, mixing, and that must have helped a sort of general acceptability for, we're talking about a couple of centuries or two or three centuries.
No, I think that's very true, and indeed there's a whole historiography that is based upon drawing this line of distinction very clearly between the early period of the British and the early years of the company, where there was a great deal of, as you say, mixing, intermarriage, adopting Indian customs, etc., and the later period where you see increasing divergence. But I'd like to pour a bit of cold water on that distinction, because when you look at Indian accounts, though in the later period there does seem to be some regret, about the British no longer being, as it were, in the midst of Indians, in fact, that's very minor as far as I can tell. And at the time, no one's particularly concerned with it. As you started out by saying, India in this period, in the period when the East India Company first got there, is an incredibly diverse place. All kinds of people inhabit it, speaking many different languages, professing many different religions. They don't all interact. So in traditional Indian society, if such a thing can be said to exist, divisions of religion, caste, etc., meant that people might speak to each other, but they wouldn't dine, they wouldn't intermarry. So it's not a strange thing.
Before I move on for a second, we'll be talking a lot about the sepoys, the sepoy army. This is the name that the Indian army had, very much admired by Wellington years earlier when he was in India, and that's where he said he learned all his craft with the sepoy army. How content was this army? They were tended to be British officers at the sepoy with the army. How content were they with the company rule in the 1850s, just before the mutiny? Because they were a massive army.
Yes, again, there are different opinions on this. We are told a lot of the opinions we have on the contentedness or otherwise of the sepoys comes from during or after the mutiny, because this wasn't so much a concern before the mutiny. So we are told that the annexation of the kingdom of Awadh, for instance, was something that upset the army.
I'm coming to that in a moment, yeah.
And yeah, we will return to that.
But on the whole, it was quite a good profession, provided they were paid the wages they said they were going to be paid.
Indeed.
And Indians were used to going to war and being warriors, and so that was, they slipped into that.
Indeed, if you look at Indian accounts of the army, they're uniform in describing the sepoys as being proud, vainglorious, and you know, extremely loyal to their masters. They don't feel themselves to be somehow enslaved or slighted by the British.
Can I turn to Shruti now, Shruti Kapila? In the just to get to finish off with the background, then we can go to the mutiny. Just to give the context, it was thought in the 1850s that the company was becoming intrusive or bureaucratic, taking more directions and the wrong sort of directions from London and so on. Can you give us some? Can you, that was said at the beginning, but can you?
I mean, I think
plump that up a little.
Sure. I mean, one thing is clear that that there is a crisis of authority and legitimacy, because what is the company at this point is up for grabs. What does it represent, and who does it represent? Certainly, the empire or the imperial rule has become very agrarian based. It's much more autocratic. It is much more dependent upon land taxation and revenue to actually keep up for this army that you've been talking about. The Bengal army is in itself more than 100,000 sepoys. So in that sense, the East India Company or the company officials have gotten into, as it were, the everyday local politics of India, which is a critical backdrop to what happens with 1857.
When you say get involved in, can you give us an instance of
that? I mean, I would say by the 1820s, 30s, they have a bureaucrat in most princely kingdoms or courts of India, not just the Mughal Empire. So what was called the resident. And this actually, in a way, bureaucratized the relationship increasingly between Indian society and British rule. And this meant that the earlier hybrid structures of legitimacy that existed in the 18th century became, as it were, more removed from the British. So in that sense, there was really very little political legitimacy or a language of legitimacy for the British at this point. And also the company and also the 1840s is a period of deep international crisis, which is why Marx gets interested in India.
And he writes about it.
Absolutely. I mean, he's a correspondent.
In the New York Times.
Absolutely,
he writes, yeah.
Because post-1848, he turns to Asia to think of this is where the revolution is actually going to take place. So in that sense, actually, the company is in crisis, both as a commercial entity, but also as a political entity, because neither the parliament is clear what it represents, nor is it very clear to Indians what British authority is.
A very good specific example for our listeners was touched on by Faisal, but if you could explore it, and that's the annexation of the princely kingdom of Awadh. Now, why was that so important, and why could it be called, one hesitates about this in any, a turning point?
Well, it was a trigger point for certain.
Can you give us the date and be specific?
It is sort of May 1856 when Awadh is annexed. It is outside of the Mughal Empire, the largest Muslim princely state or princely kingdom, and it lies between, strategically between Delhi, which is the Mughal capital, and Calcutta on the east, which is the British capital, and it is part of the Gangetic heartland, and therefore very, very important for revenue taxation. Secondly, this is also where all the sepoys are recruited from. So this is strategically important, and symbolically it's very important, because this is actually where, towards the late 18th century, you actually get a sense of Muslim revival, if you could say, in terms of courtly practices after the decline of Delhi.
Why did the East India Company annex it? Why did they go and annex it? They must have known it would have caused a lot of trouble. So why did they want?
Because the local ruler had decided not to pay the revenue and had
tax again.
Tax. I mean, it was absolutely revenue and tax, and that sort of sparks off And also, I think it's also, I think the point that we're now it is becoming increasingly clear that the British are becoming a very, a territorial power, but a territorial power which, as Nehru says, 100 years later, which has no local loyalty. This is a territorial. So the issue, as Faisal was saying earlier, is not about foreign aliens versus, you know, something indigenous, but the issue is the British are not seen to be loyal to the people they're ruling over.
Chandragul, let's move on. Let's start with the mutiny now in 1857. The issue of rifles and cartridges seems to be one of the immediate local trigger points. Can you just describe that and then let's get going with the mutiny?
Well, the new Enfield rifles had been introduced several months before the mutiny outbreak of the mutiny, and it involved sepoys having to bite off a cartridge in order to get the powder from the cartridge to load the rifle. And this covering was said to be, rumoured to be, made with cow and pig fat, so therefore alienating Hindu and Muslim religious sensibilities. When sepoys refused to buy this cartridge, they were imprisoned. And in response to their imprisonment, the rest of the garrison in Meerut rose up, you know, freed them, and then decided to march to Delhi. That was in May 1857.
It wasn't as straightforward as that, because they shot some officers, the British officers.
Yes, so, of course.
We had violence there from the start, violence on both parts. But they didn't just rise up and say, we'll go for a march.
No.
They shot the officers. And the person most responsible was immediately hanged by the British.
Well, Yes. But I think it's quite ironic that the soldiers, they used the whole issue of the cartridge of the Enfield rifle and you know, mutinied, but then had no hesitation in using these very rifles when they marched to Delhi to fight the British. There is an irony there. But I do think that this was a catalyst, and it sort of symbolised long-held growing resentment, particularly in the Bengal army, which is what the regiment that mutinied. And it's quite important to distinguish the fact that the Bombay and the Madras armies actually remained quite loyal. The Bengal army was peculiar because it was composed of very high caste Hindus, predominantly Brahmins and Rajputs. So in a way, caste, any slight on their caste and associations with caste and religious slurs, intended or intended by the British, caused a great deal of disaffection in this army, more than others.
But it's very dramatic, isn't it, Faisal? Let's turn to you. They shoot their officers, and then they march, an enormous number of them. They turn towards Delhi, the capital of the old Mughal Empire. When they get there, they find the last Mughal emperor, a gentle old man who didn't want anything to do with it, really, and insisted that he was now in charge. He was their man. Can you just fill out that a bit? What happened in that march? And is that particular incident which Chandrika's described, was that enough to set it off, or were more things happen?
Well, I mean, that incident becomes, of course, absolutely crucial in the retelling of the story of the mutiny, both among Indians and among the English, from the time of the mutiny itself. What interests me, however, is, you know, just before the violence breaks out, there are a whole series of complicated negotiations between the sepoys, or rather their leaders, and various British officers in places like Behrampur, right, where they say to the British, look, we suspect these cartridges. We ourselves, the sepoys, are not necessarily averse to biting these cartridges, but our friends and families will ostracize us if we do so. So we need to test these things. And there are these curious set of experiments that are conducted where, you know, they dip the cartridges in water to see whether there's oil in them or not. And then they'll say, well, they might or might not be greased with cow or pig fat, but even if they aren't, we really cannot afford to risk ostracism from our people. And so what we need to do is grease them ourselves with some vegetable form of grease, and if you don't permit us to do this, then we will just refuse to cooperate with you. So there's a whole set of negotiations which are entirely civil, and the British accounts describe them as being perfectly well-mannered. So there's no attempt at rebellion or even
so
a display of rebellion.
When does it break into shooting and hanging?
It's when you have the trials of some of the people who refuse to follow orders. people are hanged, and entire troops are disbanded and sent off in chains. And that really seems to, you know, bring together the rest of the Bengal army and decide them upon violence.
So how can this is more crucial than I thought. So had the British decided at that stage, look, we've got this wrong, we can use a different sort of oil to, and we can get ourselves out of this after these cartridges have been spent quite soon. Was there any attempt ever to think of doing that?
Well, I think it's kind of regardless, because I think it's also a rebellion that spreads because of rumour and information. So it's not actually about the veracity about these grease cartridges, but it's the potency of this information to actually move from, as it were, the east to the western frontier, which causes the mutiny to spread. So that rumour could actually be anything, but it's the spread of that rumour and information which actually makes it move from, as it were, from the barracks to the countryside. And also the other thing is that these mutineers, so-called mutineers, actually leave their uniforms and go home, because this is where they're being recruited from. So you actually get, as it were, from an armed rebellion, I mean, you get actually, in a sense, what you get is a peasant armed. This is what you're getting, and by dropping off the uniform. And as they're moving, local notables, who are actually pretty hard put out by British taxation, are joining them. So this is how actually it spreads. So I mean, actually, I think the grease cartridges issue is actually neither here nor there, because this is it's a symbolic sort of transaction of information.
So it isn't just the sepoy who become what you call the peasants' army, although we were told a few minutes ago that there were Brahmins at there, so I'm a bit worried about the peasants' army, because there were notables who joined in, there were the
princely courts who joined in. But I don't want to make this into seriously just a caste or issue, or one which is just about, as it were, cultural sentiment. I mean, of course, this is also a very tired army.
Sure.
It's an army which has just won Punjab and Burma for the British, or rather, it's about to be sent off to Burma. And so there are real issues about that. But I think what is interesting about the mutiny is that the way it actually switches from being a rebellion of the sepoys to something that moves into the countryside very, very quickly.
Can I come to you, Shanika? Tell us about the siege of Lucknow, which gives us again a point, an illustration of where things had got to.
Well, I think the siege of Lucknow, I mean, we have to talk about it almost over a year, because there were several sieges of Lucknow, just like in Delhi, which took about from June to September for the British to reconquer Delhi. Lucknow also fell for the first time in the summer of 1857, and it wasn't recaptured. The final siege of Lucknow was only in March 1858. Mm. So we're talking about several months when the British made abortive attempts to try and take Lucknow, with armies brought down from the Punjab in the north, and also in pincer movements from Calcutta.
Are these Indian armies?
Indian armies, sepoy armies, but also reinforcements had by that time arrived, been diverted from China, as well as from the Crimea, of course, where they had been fighting just before the mutiny broke out. So they were reinforced armies, but predominantly they were sepoy armies, because the British officer content and the number of British officers was very, very few. And that's the irony. You were Indians fighting against other Indians.
This became noted for the atrocities. So can you give us some idea of the level of atrocity in Lucknow? Let's stay there.
As far as the British were concerned, I think even before Lucknow, it was Kanpur, which was the site of the biggest sort of response to Indian massacring. And here we've got the Maratha, Nana Sahib, who's supposed to have taken a group of defenseless, hundreds of defenseless women and children who had been promised safe passage. Mm. And then they were massacred at the last minute. And this was before Lucknow. So you've got
You said supposed to. Were they or weren't they?
I beg your pardon?
You said supposed to. He's supposed to have taken, you said.
Kanpur.
That's right. Did he or didn't he take these hundreds of women? Because that's very important
Yes, it is. But again, here we have to distinguish between those leaders at the top, whether the orders came from them or whether this was a knee-jerk reaction of the smaller officers, the sort of, if you like,
yeah, we
the
have to distinguish
chieftains.
That. But in terms of the argument, discussion that we're going to have, because the British reprisals were extremely brutal. But I want to start here. This was the murdering, the massacring of British women and children.
Yes, it was.
It did take place.
And it was in public. And the thing about it was that it was actually witnessed on the River Ghats. And that's what made it actually quite potent for tens of thousands of Indians to watch Europeans being killed.
And the news of this got back to Britain very emphatic terms, because William Howard Russell, the great Times reporter who reported on Crimea and, as it were, exposed what was really happening in Crimea, went to India, asked to go to India, and came there and exposed what the British were up to in India. So can you address him for a moment, one of you, and his influence?
Yes, of course. I mean, Russell was, of course, the famed war correspondent, the hero of Crimea, and he was sent by the Times, which was the most important British newspaper. He arrived at a later stage in the mutiny. He only arrived at the beginning of 1858. But the interesting thing about Russell is that he moved with the troops, and he conversed with the common subaltern and sepoy, as well as with the commander. So he got information from both ends. He was appalled. He essentially brought it down to two issues. He talked about race. It was about race, and it was about religion. So, for example, his response to Kanpur was that what offended British sensibilities in London was not so much that a massacre took place, but that the massacre was by black men against defenseless women, white women and children. So he certainly saw the race angle to this, and the whole idea that this was a war of religion, the idea that this was about Christianity and barbarism. But also what he was concerned about, the reason he was sent, was to report on the veracity of the atrocity stories, not just in Kanpur, but in general.
Yeah.
And so he basically found no evidence for this.
I'm getting confused here, because I've read nothing but atrocity stories for the last week, and you keep dodging it and saying not much happened. We've got to get this straight, because there was full of atrocities, extreme atrocities, or it wasn't. And you three should know better than anybody else, I just want it cleared up.
The massacre that is witnessed on the safe passage that Chandrika was alluding to, that was in Kanpur. And then, of course, there is this issue of actually holding up European women and children in what came to be called the Bibi Ghar. No one knows what happens, because this is actually not a public massacre. And this actually, historians say, is a shift from something that actually you get rebels winning to rebels losing out.
There was also a great deal. The British reprisals with this were very vicious, strong, firing people from cannons. I'd just like to get some idea of both sides. Faisal, can you come in there?
Well, to begin with, let me just focus for a while on another massacre, a much lower level massacre, if you will, in Delhi. Mm. So there were certain, English women and children who had been sheltered in the palace of the last Mughal emperor, who was the nominal head of the mutiny. There was a struggle because the mutineers wanted to take them out and kill them. Eventually, they were, despite the king's remonstrances, they were in fact taken out and killed publicly. This created a huge stir in Delhi, so that the inhabitants of Delhi said that we can no longer hold faith with the mutineers. They have betrayed our trust. This is not the way in which rulers are supposed to manage their affairs. And this is a sign from heaven that the British will win. So it worked completely against the mutineers. But what is interesting about that story is the fact that it's exactly the same kind of sentiment that had spurred the mutineers themselves and the other Indians who helped them to rise against the British. It's not any different. And so the Mughal emperor himself then, for instance, says, look, we have our, as it were, rules of war. And these have been broken by the mutineers. Not even Genghis Khan or Tamerlane did perform such barbarous acts as the mutineers did.
Hold on, we're just trying to get this right. So we've had a lot about the Indian massacres, the Indian atrocities, but there were massive atrocities on the part of the British. Now, I haven't got to terms with that yet. So are you going to tell me about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Delhi, for example, let's start with Delhi. I mean, when Delhi was taken over, I mean, the poet Ghalib said that all he could see was an ocean of blood. I mean, this kind of atrocities meted out by British troops in Delhi, it was an indiscriminate slaughter of any male who was not white.
And this is what Russell reported on and criticised.
Well, Russell wasn't there at the time because Russell only arrived in India towards the end of 1857, 1858. But he went there because of these stories that made their way back to the British press and then were taken up as these sort of the unfolding crisis of British legitimacy, this cry for vengeance that came upon when these stories made their way back. But it's interesting because when the British were seen to be taking vengeance, it was rightful and just and a Christian act against a barbarous, unjust, disloyal, mutinous army.
It was seen like by some people, I don't think it was seen like that by everybody. When you're back in London, Disraeli doesn't think that. Russell doesn't think that. And Disraeli's prime minister. And
Disraeli's not prime minister. Disraeli's the deputy leader in the House of Commons, the Conservatives.
Sorry, I made a mistake there, but he gets to be prime minister. He's an important voice.
I agree entirely. I think Disraeli's really important. But what he's doing is using the mutiny as a way of attacking Whigs and liberals and their government. He basically wants Palmerston to admit that the mutiny is more than just a mutiny, that it is a national revolt. Yes. And his argument essentially is that it's been caused because the British have decided that liberal principles need to be applied to govern India and have disregarded all the traditional sentiments that exist in India.
Liberal principles like trying to ban Sati, that for instance.
Exactly, Lord Bentinck's social reforms and banning Sati, widow remarriage. Yeah. I mean, in actual fact, these didn't have that much impact. Where they did have an impact was on perceptions.
Right. I think there's also the issue about war and what war means to Britain at this point. I mean, I think outside of the Crimea, the British have seen nothing like the scale of destruction that is seen in northern India. And in fact, it's quite interesting that Russell and the other photographer, Beato, who both kind of actually chronicled Crimea, are the ones who also chronicle the mutiny. And under actually the company's permission, they're actually sent by, they're given passes by the company to document it. But also there's an internal tussle in terms of actually whether war is a professional business, or is it something which is down to heroes and aristocrats. And I think the mutiny exposes that problem, I think, in British politics about middle classes and indeed the aristocracy.
I think, just to add to what Shruti has just said, it's important to see the mutiny along with the Crimean War that has already been mentioned that just preceded it and the American Civil War that comes after it as, you know, one of the three most important early modern wars, or I should say not early modern, but modern wars. That is to say, wars that are, despite all the statements of, you know, laws of war, that target civilians, that deal with massacres, sack cities in ways that were previously unknown, where terms are not offered. Even Tamerlane offered terms, and Genghis Khan offered terms. What gets back to Britain, I think it's a cumulative anxiety. It's not only the mutiny, and it's, you know, it's aura of, you know, why Indians are more savage than white people.
Just one second, because we've got a little way to go. Now, it's getting back to Britain, and I was wrong about him being Prime Minister, although he was to be and have an influence through Victoria on that. But let's say he was the leading Conservative politician. And his response, which you are implying was merely a domestic response in a manoeuvring in... It might have been an outrage that he had. I would suggest to you, Disraeli had that in him to be outraged. And a lot of British people, when they found out what the British troops had done, they too were outraged. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just that. It wasn't that sort of easy. I mean, as you described on the Indian thing, there were the Indians, as it were, in Delhi were against the mutineers who and so on and so forth. But let's talk. Let's just try to bring it back to London for a moment. What effect did Disraeli and those like-minded have on changing British public opinion, which at one stage was all for vengeance, all for blood vengeance, yes, never been seen since the days of Napoleon. How did that attitude that they had change it?
Well, Disraeli is anything but simple. He's a most complex man. And for him, India is part of this great Asiatic mystery. I think he firmly believes that the only way to rule India is through the imagination. And therefore, you know, to appeal to the imagination of Indians through allying with the conservative holders of power, the Rajas, the traditional aristocrats and leaders of civil society. But Disraeli gets a chance to actually have a direct impact on the framing of the act which follows, the 1858 Act, because, of course, Derby comes into power in March 1858, and Disraeli then becomes the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he has a big role to play in how British post-mutiny response to governing India take shape. And I'd like to summarize this as, in sort of saying that the lesson that Disraeli and others took from the mutiny was not a victory of the British, but it was a moral tale. It was a tale of morality, what not to do. So the British government was henceforth not about interfering with Indian indigenous traditions and trying to modernize India, but it was about allying with those very indigenous traditional power rulers like the princes in having a kind of symbiotic relationship with them to shore up a much more conservative Raj.
And I think actually I would argue slightly differently that actually what the mutiny does is it hands the empire to the liberal imperialists, which means that, of course, you can't have a rule by sword and that you will have a government which is based on bureaucratic rationality, distance and so on, which the liberals had been calling for since the 1830s. So in that sense, it's a victory for them. The kind of violence, in that sense, violence is very transformative of the political structures between India and Britain from there on. So in that sense, actually, this question about distance that we make or about non-interference that we make post-mutiny is over actually stated, because you do have legislations throughout the 19th century on religion, representation by the early 20th century on the basis of religion. So I think that's overstated, but the point is that empire now would be ruled, it will be something that would be done on liberal principles.
And curiously enough, Faisal, the liberal principle was embodied in Queen Victoria to a certain extent, wasn't it?
Yes, and that's one of the great... it's also one of the great stories of the mutiny, which is that...
She became the empress. She was called the empress.
Yes, she became the first empress of India.
Yeah.
And though there had been previous empresses, that is to say Indian monarchs who were women, indeed, I'd like to mention here as an aside that the mutiny itself, one of the reasons why it's so interesting is it gave rise to some quite powerful women leaders who took the field. The most important among them are the Rani of Jhansi, but also Hazrat
Mahal.
Who
was killed in battle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dressed as a Pathan, dressed as a man, as a Pashtun man. And Hazrat Mahal, the queen mother of Awadh, who with her young son Birgis Qadar.
So there's a tradition there, but we come to Queen Victoria,
yes.
And she's put there. And what is her influence, if any, over the next decades? And how is India settled after this rebellion? What is the new, let's call it the new settlement, for the sake of convenience?
Well, I mean, the great document here is the Queen's Proclamation of 1858, which Chandrika has referred to. And in this document, Queen Victoria is made to announce that British rule will be henceforth a rule of non-interference and tolerance, where religious groups will be treated equally, etc. In a way, you can see it as a charter of Indian secularism at a period when England itself is not secular, where there's an established church and the Queen is the head of it. So that itself is very, very interesting. More interesting yet is the fact that Indian notables take to this proclamation in a massive way, so that it takes by surprise even the British statesmen who had issued it, that they hold on to it, they like it, but they use it over the decades after the mutiny against the British bureaucracy in India itself. So it gets to be their Magna Carta, their Charter of Freedom. They appeal to the monarch against what they see as a tyrannical bureaucracy.
But
it's a curious
thing.
Bureaucrat.
Yeah. It sort of takes me right back to the point I was making about a certain segment of British political elite talking about a kind of re-orientalism, using the figure of monarchy to try and create an Indian nation, which was, had loyalties that transcended the local and the secular.
Victoria was a Mughal empress, really.
Exactly. That's how Disraeli saw it, certainly. And that's how Punch depicted Disraeli, handing over her royal crown to that to get an Indian one in turn. And certainly I think this is part of that whole picture, the kind of conservatism that underlay a great deal of what you would, what Shruti talked about as a liberal imperialism. I mean, I don't think in actual fact it was much liberal at all. It was in the guise of, you know, certain attitudes to reform. Exactly. But in actual fact, the kind of conservatism that underlay the entire second half of the 19th century, I don't think can be denied.
But I think on Victoria, I think it's an under sort of remembered fact that she also declared a Day of Atonement for the violence that happened in India. And in that sense, actually, from then on, you could say that India becomes very much, much part of the British national script. Because since up until then, it had an awkward relationship with Britain. But by, you know, becoming the Empress of India, I mean, India is very much part of what British nationality will now thereon mean.
It was an invented tradition of associating the monarchy with imperialism. And this is very much part of the conservative attitude to empire.
Because you're all so full of facts and vim and energy, this tiny bit tiny. But was there a sea change in the way the British were seen and saw themselves after this? We've talked earlier on in the century, very largely and loosely in a way, but not entirely inaccurately, about the British marrying in, learning customs, learning languages. There's plenty of evidence for that. But now they have a different... They are perceived differently. Would you agree with that, Faisal?
Yes, but in a way, this different perception is not a bad thing, I think, as it has been made out to be. Mm. Because if you look at the mutiny demands, the thing that they're really worried about is not that the British are excluding them from their society. They're worried about the British including Indians in their society. Because the great claim against the British, against the East India Company, is that they want to convert Indians to Christianity. Yeah. And therefore make them undifferentiated. And the whole thing about India as an empire, as an Indian empire, is that it's made up of a series of differences that cohabit, that live according to different kinds of rules that are very, very important and interesting. And so therefore it's not the resentment that the British are keeping aloof that inspires the mutineers. It's the contrary. They don't want to be part of British society. So they're quite happy for the British to adopt Indian wives and habits and
so
all the rest.
So the question of distance is mutual.
Yeah, it's not...
The question of polity is where the issue is at, because I think it is the British nation which is fighting a war against a much more fragmented or competing sets of empires in India.
And I think in one respect you could see this as replacing the kind of oriental despotism that the British thought represented large segments of Indian polity before the mutiny with a kind of benevolent despotism where the British would then decide what was good for the Indians in terms of their, you know, social, legal and right across the board. And it was a very liberal perception in that respect, but in actual fact it didn't work out that way.
Well, thank you very much. That's been a terrific gallop across the plains. Thank you, Shruti Kapila, Chandrika Kaul, Faisal Devji. Next week, yes, The Theology of Calvinism. Thank you for listening.
If you've enjoyed this Radio 4 podcast, why not try others, such as Thinking Aloud, where Laurie Taylor discusses the latest social science research. To find out more, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.